Academy. Designated a naval flight officer in 1979, Admiral Harris has had a remarkable 40-year career in uniform where he has commanded at the highest levels of the United States military, including the United States Pacific Fleet and United States Indo-Pacific Command. His graduate education included Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, Georgetown's School of Foreign Service, and Oxford. After retiring from the Navy in 2018, Admiral Harris became the 23rd ambassador to South Korea. Admiral Harris has logged over 4,400 flight hours, including 400 combat hours in maritime patrol and reconnaissance aircraft. And once again, our featured guest this evening, please welcome to the stage, Admiral, retired, Harry Harris.
Hey folks, let's give it up one more time for our sponsors, especially the big sponsors, NFCU and Kia Motorsports. Thanks. So thanks, Brent, for that terrific introduction. You know, the person who introduces a keynote speaker has a tough job because you've got to let the audience know that the fun part of the evening is over. And bravo Zulu to Admiral Cozad and Captain Gilliam and the museum team for putting together a great show and all of the other folks that touched this building. So, Senator Boxen, Congresswoman Salzman, thanks for your service, your Army service. Sheriff Simmons, fellow flag officers, civic and military leaders, veterans, especially the veterans, and ladies and gentlemen, good evening, and I'm honored to be introduced by Brent Lang, radio celebrity, civic booster, Country Music Association Award winner, and a great American, even if he is from California. But I have to confess, when I was told that he was going to introduce me, I was a little bit relieved because I thought that Captain Gilliam was going to introduce me. And in my experience, when a naval aviator gets his hands on a microphone, he reverts back to talking about what he knows best, which is about himself. So thanks, Brent, for introducing me. And isn't this museum the perfect venue for this occasion? A national treasure, if there ever was one. Folks, I'm thrilled to be with you this evening and join you here in what is truly a Navy town. Of course, this is a special treat for me to return to Pensacola. I grew up just 10 miles from here, 2 blocks from the Krispy Kreme on Savannah's and 9th. I went to AV Clubs, middle school, and Washington High School back in the days when Booker T was on to hard drive. Go Wildcats. Right after my family moved here in 1968, I saw the Blue Angels for the very first time, my very first time. And they flew F-4 Phantoms then. And I was hooked. I knew I wanted to fly a Navy. Which is, when you think about it, why we have the Blues. I went to flight training here. My folks are buried about 2 blocks from here in Branca Cemetery. So it's good to be home. Now, although many things have changed since I lived here, I suspect the one thing that hasn't changed is the attitude of Pensacolians toward long-winded admirals and generals who are asked to give a speech, then instead give a verbal manifesto. I won't do that. After all, one of history's greatest speeches was given by President Lincoln, and it lasted just over 2 minutes. Julius Caesar gave what may have been the longest speech in history, and his best friends killed him. So I get the message. So, ladies and gentlemen, the Florida Panhandle is an incredible place with significant connections to our nation's security. There's Tyndall in Panama City, Whiting in Milton, and Eglin and Harbor over in Okaloosa County. But the crown jewel, in my opinion, is Pensacola Naval Air Station. A round of applause, please. Please continue your applause for Senator Broxson, a native Pensacolan, a force of nature in the Florida Senate, and an amazing supporter of the Navy and the Naval Aviation Museum. In fact, he dreamed up Navy Days. He also spearheaded the naming of the new bridge linking Pensacola and Gulf Breeze, the General Chaffee James Bridge. Thank you, sir, for doing that. Four-star General Chaffee James was an alum of Washington High School, and one day in 1970, he came to Booker T to address the student body. I was just a freshman then, and he was a brand new one-star. So we were all awed by him, of course. He stood in the middle of the basketball court, and the students were all in the bleachers. Well, he said something to the effect that if he could become a general, so could we. And I believe that he spoke directly to me. Of course he didn't, but to my dying day, I choose to believe that he did. So in my current life, I spend a great deal of time speaking in short sentences on subjects about which I know very little. But tonight, I'm blessed to discuss a subject about which I know a great deal, and that's the power and glory of naval aviation, its deep roots in this magnificent city, and the threats that our nation faces, especially in the Indo-Pacific, the very threats which those women and men who train here may one day confront as they defend America in faraway places. So, this is a fitting venue indeed for me to share with you my thoughts on those threats and the importance of the Indo-Pacific region through the twin lenses of having commanded the Indo-Pacific Command and as your ambassador to South Korea. I'll give you a tour of the horizon of the region against this backdrop, a dozen wave tops. As a preamble, one more thing that I know about Floridians is that we're known for being straight shooters. So, point blank, I believe in 2024, we're at an inflection point in history. We're certainly not near anything resembling the end of history. Freedom, justice, and the rules-based system hang in the balance, and the scale won't tip of its own simply because of wishful thinking. So let's do this. Here are my dozen wave tops. Number one, President Reagan once said that we cannot play innocence abroad in a world that's not innocent. This statement is as true today as it was in 1941, throughout the Cold War, on 9/11, on the 24th of February 2022, when Russia invaded Ukraine, and the 7th of October last year when Hamas attacked Israel. The world remains a dangerous place. The unipolar moment following the Cold War is over. Two, the U.S. has enduring interests in the Indo-Pacific, a region at a precarious crossroad where tangible opportunity meets significant challenge. So, while our opportunities remain abundant, the path ahead is burdened by several considerable challenges, including an aggressive North Korea, a revisionist People's Republic of China, a revanchist Russia, and now a dangerous and growing alignment between these three and with Iran. Since the beginning of this century, the situation has worsened in almost every geostrategic measure. Consider that North Korea has tested nuclear weapons and the means to deliver them to our very shores. Consider that Taiwan is under siege. Israel finds itself fighting once again for its very existence. Ukraine is ablaze. Eastern and Northern Europe are under a threat, and your Navy is involved in countering Houthi rebels who have effectively shut down commercial shipping in the Red Sea. Three, the Biden administration's national security strategy underscores America's vital interests in the Indo-Pacific region that's open, interconnected, prosperous, secure, and resilient. Though I would use the term adversary rather than competitor, this strategy recognizes that the PRC is the only competitor with both the intent and increasingly the capability to reshape the international order. It emphasizes that America's single greatest asymmetric strength is our network of alliances and partnerships. As I testified before the Senate just last month, today we face a security environment more complex and volatile than I have ever experienced. Today, more than ever, alliances are critical to our national security. Alliances and allies matter. Four, since I was your ambassador to South Korea, I'll take the speaker's prerogative is spend a few minutes on the U.S.-South Korea alliance. 71 years strong and counting. 4 years in a devastating conflict, it has stood the test of time. It's mind-boggling to consider how much has changed in the world in general, Northeast Asia in particular, and the Korean Peninsula especially, since 1953. Some changes have been for the better, such as South Korea's miraculous growth into an economic and cultural powerhouse, a vibrant democracy, a high-tech innovation nation. Other changes have been for the worse. Why is North Korea so far away in Northeast Asia a challenge for the entire world? Well, the answer is simple. Kim Jong-un's missiles point in every direction. Today, North Korea stands out as the only country this century to have tested nuclear weapons. North Korea is ruled with an iron fist by a brutal dictator who values power over the prosperity and welfare of his own people. The North's unrelenting pursuit of nuclear weapons, the means to deliver them, and its unmitigated aggression toward South Korea and America should concern us all. I believe the KGU wants four things: sanctions relief, to keep its nukes, to split our alliance, and to dominate the peninsula. Last September, he stated unequivocally that he'd never give up his nukes, and the North Korea status as a nuclear weapon state is irreversible. Last January, by declaring that the North would no longer seek peaceful reunification with the South, he abandoned a foundational doctrine of the communist regime. And now he's trading low-cost weapons for Russian technology. Why am I not surprised? None of this sounds like he's going to get rid of his nuclear weapons anytime soon. In fact, he's telling us precisely the opposite. Now, while we hope for diplomacy with North Korea to be successful, we must recognize that hope alone is not a course of action. The quest for dialogue with the North must never be made at the expense of the ability to respond to threats from the North. Dialogue and military readiness must go hand in hand. Idealism must be rooted in realism. By his declarations and actions, KGU has eliminated any remaining fantasy about the potential peaceful reunification with South Korea. Let's not sugarcoat his words, ladies and gentlemen. Let's take them at face value. I believe our heretofore U.S. policy goal of negotiating away North Korea's nuclear program has reached its useful end. We must up our combined game. Deterrence by appeasement is not deterrence at all. Okay, number five, Japan. America's alliance with Japan stands as a cornerstone of security and stability throughout the region. It's 60 years strong this year. Japan's remarkable commitment to dramatically increase its defense spending to historic levels is both welcome and critical to our alliance and the stability in the region. Tokyo's decision to move surface-to-ship missiles to Okinawa is part and parcel of the buildup and is both an example and clear recognition of the twin threats from China and North Korea. Now to number six, and that's the elephant in this room and in all rooms, and that's China. As you all know well, there are very few bipartisan issues in Washington these days, but our national concern about the PRC is one of them. To be clear, the U.S. has partnered well with China on several important fronts, but Washington and Beijing fundamentally disagree on how to approach the current international order. The PRC simply does not keep its word, from its treaty with the British on Hong Kong to its human rights abuses against the Uyghurs, the Tibetans, and others, to commercial espionage and the weaponization of debt, and to its quest to intimidate, isolate, and dominate Taiwan. As I testified before the U.S. Senate when I was in uniform and again last month dressed, well, almost like this, now I believe Beijing seeks hegemony, not only in East Asia, but Greater Asia and beyond. The PRC wants to set the rules for the region, indeed the world. Now, I know that the Biden administration's fundamental understanding of the PRC is consistent with its predecessor. Consider the Secretary of State Blinken testified that the previous administration's tougher approach to China is right, that what's happening in Xinjiang is genocide, and the democracy is being trampled in Hong Kong. Secretary Austin testified that he's focused on the threat posed by the PRC, and he promised strong support for Taiwan. I, for one, was glad to see President Biden meet with Chinese leader Xi Jinping in San Francisco on the margins of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit last November. Churchill said that it's better to jaw than shoot. However, as with North Korea, idealism must be rooted in realism. Just consider Beijing's clear support for Russia, for North Korea, for Iran, for Syria, and for the Taliban. I'm an advocate for reinforcing diplomacy with hard power when dealing with Beijing. Now, this brings me to number seven, and this is Taiwan. Look, Taiwan is democratic, an idea factory, and a global force for good, despite the PRC's unrelenting quest to destroy it or to absorb it. I've called for ending the U.S. policy of strategic ambiguity in favor of strategic clarity. The Indo-Pacific strategy that I mentioned earlier specifically supports an environment in which Taiwan's future is determined peacefully by the Taiwanese. What a concept. Unlike our policy of strategic ambiguity, the PRC's intent is crystal clear. We must never allow China to dictate our policy toward Taiwan. My successor in Indo-Pacific Command testified before Congress in 2021 that the PRC could invade Taiwan in 6 years. That's 2027. We ignore Admiral Davidson's warning at our peril. Importantly, this year also marks the 45th anniversary of the Taiwan Relations Act. In my opinion, without the U.S. Congress's active intervention back in 1979, when the 96th Congress, crafted this act, Taiwan would have long ago succumbed to the PRC. Now, the Cato Institute, they do an annual Freedom Index. The Cato Institute's 2023 Freedom Index ranked Taiwan as the freest country in Asia. As reference points, Taiwan ranked higher than Japan, South Korea, Australia, Canada, and yes, the United States. The PRC ranked a dismal 149 out of 165 countries that were ranked. I was in Taiwan three times last year, and I visited again on DOD business last month. In my opinion, Russia on Ukraine has galvanized them. They get it, but they need our tangible support and not our best wishes. So this brings me to number eight. What about the Quad? Well, that's the informal grouping of like-minded democracies, the U.S., Australia, Japan, and India. Now, I'm a big fan and booster of the Quad. I called for its resurgence when I spoke at the inaugural Rasina Dialogue in New Delhi in 2016. Jake Sullivan calls it the foundation upon which to build a substantial U.S. policy in the region. I've called for the establishment of a Quad Secretariat headquartered somewhere in the region to coordinate what issues to take on, and perhaps to also get at the issue of how new countries can join. You know, in college football, the Big Ten used to have 14 teams, and the Big 12 used to have 10 teams. They both have 14 teams now, so there's nothing that says the Quad has to have only four teams. So, but let me be clear. The Quad is not NATO, nor will it ever be NATO. It's simply a grouping of like-minded democracies who share an outlook on the region's opportunities, challenges, and dangers. It's not a defense pact. Now, the Australia, United States, United Kingdom, or AUKUS arrangement is a defense pact, and this is my number nine. I, for one, am all for AUKUS, and I'm excited by it. I cannot wait to see a nuclear submarine under Australian colors underway in the Indo-Pacific. I don't believe that this will take decades, as some have said. After all, we put a man on the moon in 8 years, and we developed a COVID vaccine in less than 1 year. Last year, President Biden and Prime Minister Sunak in Albanese announced a plan, an eminently doable plan, in my opinion, to do just this. I'm optimistic. Now, number 10. Let me just spend a few minutes on Russia and Ukraine by first acknowledging the unconscionable human tragedy that's being perpetuated by Russia's illegal invasion of Ukraine. Moscow seeks to pressurize, terrorize, and pulverize Kyiv. As Garry Kasparov said, Russia is committing war crimes on an industrial scale in Ukraine. So why does Ukraine matter at all? Well, consider that Ukraine is a democracy and the second largest country in Europe after Russia. Consider that Ukraine sent forces to Afghanistan in support of NATO, even though it's not in NATO. Consider that Ukraine sent troops to Iraq, where they fought and died for coalition objectives. And remember, in 1994, Kyiv voluntarily gave up its nuclear weapons at the behest of the West. So why did Russia invade Ukraine at all? Two words, Vladimir Putin. Maya Angelou once said that when someone shows you who they are, believe them the first time. Folks, time and time again, Putin has shown us who he is, and shame on us if we fail to believe him. In my opinion, he seeks to rebuild the former Soviet Union, not under communism, but to its old borders. You could call it neo-imperialism, revanchism, if you will. So Kazakhstan, Georgia, Moldova, of course Ukraine, and many others are at risk. Poland and the Baltics, too, but they're a part of NATO, and that's a different nut for Putin to crack. But if we don't support NATO, those nutshells begin to look like eggshells. And why 2022? In my opinion, opportunism. Putin saw the West as weak, distracted by the pandemic. He saw America's political divisions play out in Washington, and he watched our endgame in Afghanistan. But he miscalculated, and stunningly so. He underestimated Ukraine's resolve. He might not believe that Ukraine is independent, but the Ukrainians sure do, and they're willing to fight and die for their country. He underestimated the former comedian and everyman who became the president of Ukraine. Volodymyr Zelensky has risen to his office in truly Churchillian fashion. He underestimated the resolve of the international community to undermine Russia's economic backbone. Now, while Yale School of Management concluded that over 1,000 companies have curtailed operations in Russia, and some even predicted that Russia was headed for economic oblivion, 2 years on, we know that these assessments were premature. Russia is rebounded by turning its economy into a war footing and finding new international export partners, especially in energy. Now, Putin underestimated NATO's resolve, especially Germany's, which is now the world's third largest economy. As reported last February, 18 of 31 countries are now reaching alliance military targets. Like I said, it would be 32 now. And Putin underestimated America's resolve to come together to support Ukraine with our bipartisan political determination so far. On the other hand, Putin overestimated his own strategy, a fantasy of his own making, that he could blitzkrieg Ukraine in 15 days. It's been well over 2 years now. Now, what we're seeing playing out on the battlefield are poorly trained troops led by some very bad generals, and I'll just note for the record that there are a few things that admirals like better than criticizing generals. Without adequate enabling logistics and no understanding of combined arms. Numbers are uncertain at best, but I've seen reporting that in over 2 years of hard fighting, Russia has lost has suffered over 315,000 casualties, lost thousands of tanks and armored fighting vehicles, hundreds of aircraft, and according to the New York Times, 12 general officers. Ukraine's successes on the battlefield, coupled with Russia's reliance on Wagner mercenaries, Iranian drones, North Korean artillery, and Moscow's call-up of new troops, represent to me the inherent rot in the Russian military. An exiled Russian oligarch recently said that young men are fleeing Russia not because another country invaded them, but because Russia invaded another country. And if Putin had gone to my alma mater, he'd know strategy lesson number one, which is don't lose your flagship. This is not Hungary, 1956, or Czechoslovakia, 1968. This is Finland in 1939, the Winter War. Now, Russia's actions strengthened and unified, not weakened and divided NATO, the EU, and the UN, as well as brought together I divided Washington. As the Icelandic foreign minister said last year, thank God we're a part of NATO, and now Finland and Sweden are in NATO, the exact opposite of what Putin believed would happen. In other words, he fails spectacularly, notwithstanding a certain inevitability simply because of the mass of the Russian military. What we're seeing play, and we're seeing this play out on the battlefield as well. As Stalin apocryphally said, and I say apocryphally because Stalin didn't really say it, quantity has a quality all its own. Again, Finland, but this time 1940. But don't be like Putin and underestimate the resolve of the Ukrainian people. Now, George Shultz once said that he who walks in the middle of the road gets hit from both sides. I'm proud that the United States has chosen sides with Ukraine. So far, the U.S. has provided billions of dollars to Ukraine in aid, including key military hardware. And I'm glad that we have a new Ukraine supplemental. Additionally, all the new sanctions were announced last February. There's more juice in that orange. I believe we can and must do more, including seizing the almost $300 billion in Russian assets that are held in Western financial institutions. And all this said 2 years on, I'm worried. I see Ukraine pressurized by the war of attrition that Moscow is waging against Kyiv. I see America's continued support to Ukraine challenged by those political divisions I spoke about in Washington. But I believe that Ukraine can still win, but they need our significant help. Russia has a plan to achieve its end state. Do we? Paraphrasing Aaron Applebaum's recent article in The Atlantic, is the U.S. really going to abandon Ukraine now after we rallied the world to help the Ukrainians? In my opinion, to do otherwise would be strategic folly. Finally, we must continue to expose Putin's war crimes to global audiences, including and maybe especially audiences in Russia. None of this is easy. But if we don't act with urgency, we'll find the outcomes more dire and the options more dangerous. Okay, so number 11. This brings me full circle to the issue of China on Taiwan, the implications of Russia on Ukraine. Hard to say where Beijing will land, but Xi Jinping is no fool. He craves stability in the international order so that he has time to shape that order to his favor. The very things that he seeks to weaken, the West, the U.S., the U.N., our alliances with Japan, South Korea, Australia, and the Philippines, have come together with Ukraine as a catalyst. While supportive of Russia, the PRC is not yet all in on Russia. However, in my opinion, Beijing is moving in that direction. President Biden warned China 2 years ago not to provide, quote-unquote, material support for Russia's war in Ukraine. However, earlier this month, the Secretary of State called China overwhelmingly the number one supplier of Russia's military-industrial base, which fundamentally changes the course of the war. Now, while not supplying weapons themselves, China is providing essential components, such as microelectronics, optics, and machine tools, which enables Russia to manufacture its own advanced weaponry. In my opinion, we must do more than simply draw and redraw red lines in the sand. Even so, you can be assured that Xi Jinping is watching Ukraine closely and learning. He's learning that control of the internet is vital. He's learning that drones have changed the nature of war. Unfortunately, he's also learning that the West's staying power is somewhere between 2 and 3 years. But I believe he's also wondering. He's wondering how his military, untested in sustained combat operations since the Korean War, would fare in modern 21st century warfare. He's wondering if his army, trained in the Soviet model, is as bad as Russia's appears to be, if his generals and admirals, again, trained in the Soviet model, are as inept as Russia's appears to be, and if his vaunted Navy, the PLA Navy, is as vulnerable as the Black Sea Fleet is. And finally, number 12, I'll shift both gears and geography to speak about Iran and its proxies. The attack into Israel by Hamas last October was terrorism, plain and simple. Over 1,000 Israelis, including women, children, and the elderly, were subjected to unspeakable cruelty, murder, and rape, and hundreds were taken hostage. This is pure evil, and it baffles me that there are those who seek to justify Hamas's actions. We know that Hamas, dedicated to the destruction of Israel and labeled a terrorist organization by the U.S., the U.K., Australia, and many others, that Hamas draws its support from Iran. We see Iran's support to Hamas in Gaza, of Hezbollah in Iraq and Jordan, and of the Houthis in Yemen who are using drones and missiles to attack commercial shipping in the Red Sea. The Wall Street Journal reported that Iran has provided not only sophisticated weapons, but also maritime intelligence to the Houthis regarding merchant ship location, ships upon which a significant portion of the world's trade depends. For me, I'm glad that the U.S. and our allies are finally counter-striking the Houthis. The Houthis respect strength. Everything else they regard as failure. Ultimately, however, Iran is both complicit and responsible, and Tehran, in my opinion, must also be held accountable. Okay, folks, I've been up here for a while. As a speaker, I've had two consistent complaints from previous audiences. One, that I talk so loud they can't fall asleep, and two, that I talk so long they can't stay awake. So let me wrap this up with three quick thoughts. First, we live in an interconnected world of shared spaces. The oceans, the air, outer space, and now cyberspace. These spaces enable the free flow of goods, services, and ideas. They are the connective tissue that binds together the global economy and a civil society. Access to these thoroughfares are at risk in the 21st century. Naval aviation is needed now more than ever. Second, the U.S. made two fundamentally flawed geopolitical assumptions last century. One, we assumed that China would morph into something like a global force for good, and two, that Russia would no longer threaten its neighbors or the West. Today, the Russian bear is afoot, and we find ourselves shooting well behind the Peking duck. We must step up our game, or we'll find ourselves outgunned, literally and figuratively. And thirdly and finally, we have more in common, you and I, than just an interest in Pensacola or even in naval aviation. What connects us across the generations is our shared values, our shared hopes, and our shared love of country. Today, America remains the brightest beacon for freedom and opportunity in the world. We see this play out globally every day, and especially in Ukraine today. Thankfully, our nation has always been blessed with strong women and men of exceptional courage and character, patriots who step forward to do whatever it takes to defend Lady Liberty whenever she's at risk. Your uniformed services, your clandestine services, your diplomatic corps stand the watch in an unbroken chain, generation to generation. Our battles, our victories, indeed our very way of life, are owed not to great moments or important dates. They are owed to the actions and sacrifices of individuals willing to step into the breach for their country. Now more than ever, America needs men and women who forgo wearing a business suit, forgo strolling down the easy street, and forgo living the good life, to wear instead the cloth of the nation, to sail instead on a sea fraught with peril, to live instead a life on the ragged edge of danger, to live lives that matter. America's strength depends on the synergy between those brave men and women who wear the cloth of our nation, especially those who adorn that cloth with wings of gold, and informed citizens, patriots like you, who are aware of the challenges, the opportunities, and dangers that we face around the world. So you all have what I call skin in the game. So I'm truly grateful for what you do to keep America great. Not again, but always. Thank you very much.